Now in its 10th season, Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a podcast about tragedy, triumph, unequal justice, and actual innocence. Based on the files of the lawyers who represent them, together with other criminal justice activists and experts, Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom features interviews with men and women who have spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit, some of them having even been sentenced to death. These are their stories. Look for Wrongful Conviction podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts.
A death in Minneapolis. The world is reacting. Protests across the globe in Australia, Poland, the UK. In Iran, the foreign ministry had sharp words for American leaders.
American officials and police, stop violence against your people and let them breathe.
Let them breathe. Also, Irish unions want more COVID protections at meatpacking plants.
It's highly, highly dangerous. It's affecting the communities. It's affecting the workers and their families.
And President Trump says the U.S. is revoking Hong Kong's special trade status, leaving some American businesses in Hong Kong worried.
We've been saying for the last few years, when we make visits to Washington, don't run the bus over Hong Kong. Hong Kong's a winning place to be.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For months, the pandemic has been the headline. But when the globe suddenly turns its attention to another story, a story roiling the U.S., it only makes sense to follow its gaze. Police brutality and violence and race in America, dysfunction that takes us back in our lifetimes anyway, to the Rodney King verdict in 1992, to Ferguson, Missouri after the killing of Michael Brown in 2014. We begin today in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul, where George Floyd was killed after a police officer pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes. That former police officer has now been fired and charged with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. Darnella Wade is an organizer for Black Lives Matter in St. Paul, Minnesota, and founder of the Black Truce Peace Organization. What is it like, first of all, Darnella, to be in the Twin Cities right now?
We didn't expect such a big outburst. When you watch the video, you are traumatized and you are hurt. But they took it to a place that we didn't see coming. And that is very astounding that it's the youth. It is the youth around the nation that feel the most violated. They feel it will only get worse. And I think this is a real loud cry for help. And as an organizer, we understand and we want to heal. In order for the healing to start, you have to start with discipline of the people that created the chaos.
You have solidarity protests all around the globe for what happened to George Floyd. People thinking about you in Toronto, in Berlin, in the UK, in Australia, New Zealand. How important is it to you knowing that you've got that support around the globe?
Speaking as a politician, that support is necessary. It's very important for us to understand from Minnesota out that we're trying to contain this so the rest of the world could follow our lead. And we want everybody to utilize this movement to help your legislators understand how to create policies. And I want everybody that feels like if it's right for you to protest, it's right for you to vote and create policies that help you live a better quality of life. Police need regulations. They need regulations all around the world.
Darnella, the world has seen protests over race in America before. What do you want the rest of the world to understand about what American protesters are asking for today?
Race is one aspect, because we also know that the police also take the lives of many other races and not just blacks. But what we want them to know that is no one is above the law. And it's not about your occupation. It's about your excellence to be a human being and treat others the exact same way. And we hold police to a higher standard. And we really want them to know that. And we want to be able to utilize the police for what they're utilized in the community. But if they're another gang, it's hard to trust them. And that is, for me, the motivation is to protect the youth. And I want to be protected. And also the officers in our communities and the businesses, everybody deserves protection. And that includes starting with George Floyd.
Darnella Wade, an organizer for Black Lives Matter in St. Paul and founder of the Black Truce Peace Organization, thank you very much. Stay safe. Be well.
You too. Thank you.
Over the weekend, protests over George Floyd's death spread across the country and the planet. Across the globe, protesters carried signs with Floyd's final words, "I can't breathe." There were also calls for leaders around the world to respond to the events here in the U.S. From London, the world's Orla Barry has more.
For more than 3 months now, cities across the UK have been largely quiet, in lockdown, because of the pandemic. Then at the weekend, this.
Justice for black people! Justice for all black people!
Yeah! Thousands gathered in cities across Britain, marching in protest at police brutality and the death of George Floyd.
Black lives matter!
They marched through central London, through Manchester and Cardiff. They carried cardboard signs with the words "Ignorance is a choice" and "No justice, no peace." Garin Young joined the protests in Cardiff. He says he wanted to be there because he wants to see justice for George Floyd.
Clearly something's popped in America yet again. What I do hope is that the clear demands of this movement globally now is to arrest and charge and see these policemen sentenced, not just the police officer who killed George Floyd, but also those who stood by and watched.
There were demonstrations at the American consulate in Milan too. Protests in Copenhagen and in Berlin, a large crowd gathered at the Brandenburg Gate.
We won't ignore what's happening, and we won't let anyone else ignore it anymore. Not anymore. Our lives matter.
Kristen Hayes felt compelled to go to the Berlin March after watching the video of Floyd's killing. But she says she's not exactly sure what her actions can really achieve.
I feel like helplessness, because there's only so much that I, as a white person in Berlin, can do. And that's maybe like donating and marching. Because it's going on for like 500 plus years, it's not changed in like a week or so. So it's like, yeah, helplessness mostly, I think.
And it wasn't just Germans who were making their feelings known in Berlin.
I live here every day with a confusing mixture of being homesick and being so grateful that I am not at home. I'm constantly battling the relief that I feel to be safer here than I was there, but also the guilt that I have in my stomach for leaving my family and loved ones behind.
Soccer players from Germany's professional Bundesliga showed their support too. Jadon Sancho scored a goal on Sunday and then lifted his jersey, showing the message "Justice for George Floyd" written on his T-shirt in marker. There were protests outside of Europe too. In Canada, thousands took to the streets of Toronto and Vancouver. And in faraway New Zealand, tens of thousands of people gathered on the streets of Auckland, the country's most ethnically diverse city. Marchers called on Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern to denounce the killing of George Floyd as a hate crime. Ardern has not yet responded. New Zealand's Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters instead criticised the protesters for breaking lockdown rules. Back in Britain, more protests are planned for the coming days. Garin Young in Cardiff says this isn't just an American issue.
But there is a history, a long history of police brutality with the black community here in Cardiff. I think on the back of that, and the ongoing struggles that we see, it was important for us in Cardiff to be able to demonstrate that and show the rest of the world that we exist and we stand in solidarity with their struggles.
The British Prime Minister has kept largely quiet on the issue. His Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said America needs to pull together at this time.
I'm deeply distressed by the scenes in relation to George Floyd. There is a federal review. We want to see America come back together and not tear itself apart over this.
But when asked about tweets from President Trump over the last few days regarding the violence, the Foreign Secretary said this.
I have long kept to the self-imposed guidance not to comment on what President Trump says, because it's not really what my job is.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The unrest of the last few days has put a global spotlight on President Trump to see how he'll respond. Trump has come out largely against the demonstrations in favor of stronger measures to restore law and order, as he says. One way Trump is threatening to do that, approach the protests in a similar way to the global war on terror. Steve Vladek is co-host of the National Security Law Podcast and a professor at the University of Texas Austin School of Law. Professor, let's start with terrorism law. The administration has blamed Antifa, a loose group of left-wing anti-fascism activists, for the violence without presenting any evidence. The president's tweeted that he's declaring Antifa a terrorist organization. Can he actually do that?
He can declare it whatever he wants. I think the problem is that it doesn't have any legal force. There's no mechanism under U.S. law to name a group, even a disorganized group like Antifa, as some kind of domestic terrorist organization. There's a specific procedure for designating foreign terrorist organizations, but it's really difficult to see how, you know, even the president's characterization of Antifa would bring that group within the parameters of that statute.
A couple of months ago, the State Department wanted to designate a far-right organization, the Atomwaffen, that started in the U.S. and then it spread to the U.K. and Canada and Germany. They wanted to designate it a far-right terrorist organization. So what's the difference?
So I think the difference here is that first, the Atomwaffen actually is an organization with membership and with leadership and with, you know, clearly dedicated goals. But second, I don't think that, you know, there's nearly the same evidence of the kind of ongoing foreign influence that the relevant statute, which is part of our immigration law, requires for the Secretary of State to make that kind of designation. So, you know, I think it's certainly possible that we could see noise from the State Department about designating, you know, some kind of perceived left-wing group as a foreign terrorist organization. The problem is that there are specific criteria in the statute, and you can't just satisfy those criteria on the president's say-so.
There's also chatter in Washington about invoking the Insurrection Act. Tell us what that is and what powers it gives the executive.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the other things that's, I think, you know, really important about what we're seeing in our cities is, you know, there's a question about what happens if local law enforcement is unable to respond to these disturbances. And, you know, I think there's a lot of misunderstandings out there about the relationship of two statutes. So there's a statute called the Posse Comitatus Act, which actually makes it unlawful to use the military for domestic law enforcement unless Congress has authorized it. And this is where the Insurrection Act comes into play. The Insurrection Act is a very old statute that dates back to the earliest years of our country that, among other things, does specifically authorize the president to use even regular federal troops on U.S. soil when necessary to restore order and to ensure that civilian laws are being enforced. We haven't seen the Insurrection Act used in a very long time. The last time it was used was by President George H.W. Bush in response to the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles in 1992. But it's an authority that's there entirely for moments where local law enforcement, state national guards are not able to actually restore order. And if the president determines that those circumstances are present, you know, for better or for worse, we may disagree with him, but then that satisfies the Posse Comitatus Act.
Yeah, so who sets the rules of engagement when that happens? When are those forces allowed to open fire, for example?
So, I mean, the military has very detailed operational rules of procedure and rules of engagement for when it's exercising this kind of policing function. For the most part, its job, principally, first and foremost, is to supplement civilian law authority, not to supplant it. And so the same rules, if not even more restrictive rules, for the use of force apply to the military as applies to civilian law enforcement. You know, this is why I think some of the concern about the Insurrection Act may be a bit overstated. You know, it's right to be wary of the specter of the military, you know, policing our cities. On the flip side, the actual rules that the Defense Department has adopted over the years contemplate a pretty modest role for the troops in this capacity as support, as additional manpower, as help for law enforcement, but not as the tip of any sword when it comes to, you know, quelling domestic disorder.
Steve Vladek, co-host of the National Security Law Podcast and professor at the University of Texas Austin School of Law. Thanks very much, Steve.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Hurricane season in the Atlantic starts today. Scientists are expecting it's going to be busy. They're predicting up to 19 big storms, that is, storms big enough to warrant getting named. Hurricanes are tough enough on their own, but millions of people are still recovering from last year's devastating storms in the Caribbean. Now combine that with the coronavirus and social distancing guidelines, there's some real worry about what this season's hurricanes might bring. Gina Knowles runs the Head Knowles Foundation, a hurricane relief organization in the Bahamas. They provide food and supplies to people affected by storms. Thanks for being with us, Gina. So today is the first day of hurricane season. Do you feel prepared?
Do I feel prepared? I feel like as if I'm prepared and the country's not prepared. I feel as individuals, Bahamians, we're only now starting to take hurricanes a little more serious because of the devastation we've had only of recent. I have been pumping into them for the past few months. June 1st is soon here. Get your stuff prepared. Make sure you have the stuff in your household. Don't wait for the last minute. And yes, because of the fact that we just got slammed by Dorian, then we have COVID going on. So a lot of people have lost their jobs. And I know they feel like, Gina, you're stressing us out about hurricane season. Do you know what we're dealing with in our lives? And I'm like, yes, but it's unpreventable. It's coming. We have in stock emergency supplies, and as well as we're trying to raise money to actually have bunkers on every island.
So has COVID-19 distracted from hurricane preparedness?
With my foundation, no. I think that I eat, sleep, and everything else hurricane. we have a 40,000 square foot warehouse. So when it comes to social distancing, we're good with the 6 feet apart. But what we have done is limited down to only a particular amount of volunteers each day to make sure that everybody has their space. We are still packing up food for the Hurricane Dorian survivors that go out to the islands every single week. So I have one team that deals with this is storage for hurricane coming, and this is what we're presently dealing with every week. I think we feed about 10,000 people a week throughout the different islands.
So what are your big concerns, Gina, about how COVID-19 will affect the hurricane response and how it's just going to compound the complexity of responding?
The main thing with COVID is because of the fact that everybody has lost their jobs. And that is a serious restriction of funds because usually we would get a lot more volunteers in. So there with COVID, a lot of people are scared because of social distancing. That's number one. Two is finance because they have to worry about taking care of themselves and budgeting. So that means that the actual donations slow down a lot. And because of the fact that we were feeding and helping out hurricane victims, it's hard now because we have COVID-19 people who are starting to get on in the list as well. And I must say that here in the Bahamas, our government has done very well with locking us down. Every weekend we've been locked down since March 16th, I think it was. It's so funny because of the fact that we are very loving, friendly people who we hug and kiss when we see each other. And even in a big space, we're all close together. So social distancing has been very difficult on us.
How much do you think about climate change and how that connects to the storms that you've been seeing in the Bahamas?
Climate change is a serious thing. And we have not gotten to the point as yet where that is something that's being taught like in our schools. For instance, my daughter is now learning that in her school now, and she's in her final grade. However, it's not something that we have paid attention to that much. And I try to explain to people, do you realize that change is happening? And we have to pay attention to what's going on because we've had two named already storms. So I started in May and everybody was like, what's going on here? And I keep telling people, it's like, once again, climate change, it's happening. And people aren't paying attention because they didn't expect it because June 1st is hurricane season. So they sit down and they're relaxed, waiting for June 1st almost. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking that they're soon going to have to change the dates of hurricane season to May.
Gina Knowles with the Head Knowles Foundation in the Bahamas. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The art world is grieving today after the death of conceptual artist Christo. Christo was born in Bulgaria. He went just by his first name. He didn't just create larger-than-life art installations around the world. He altered landscapes. Christo wrapped Paris's oldest standing bridge in silky fabric. He placed 3,000 umbrellas across Japan and the U.S. and lined 23 miles of New York City Central Park with saffron curtain gates. You can see Christo's work on our Instagram. We're at PRI The World. Here's the thing, though. The epic scale of Christo's art is at odds with the brief lifespan of a lot of those works. Many of his titanic installations were on display for just 2 weeks. A 1962 piece called The Iron Curtain appeared in a Paris alley for a mere 8 hours. That, as Christo explained at a lecture in 2010, was by design. The work that he created with his late wife and frequent collaborator Jean-Claude, he compared its temporary nature to our childhoods.
We know the childhood will be gone, that our life, that life will be gone. And the temporary project, you have this presence of missing. When the people go to see our project, they're in presence of something, tomorrow we'll be gone forever.
Temporary and not cheap. Some of Christo's most ambitious installations cost upwards of $20 million, every penny of which came directly from Christo himself and Jean-Claude. No donations, no taxpayer contributions, no corporate sponsors. Christo used money he got from selling his collectible art to fund his passion projects. He said this allowed him to give his fleeting installations their own kind of freedom.
We possess so many things. Collectors owns, museums owns, people owns. It's something is so big, it cannot charge tickets, cannot own, is there, and after a few days it's gone.
Christo's work also intentionally lacks social or political messaging. The art, as his wife Jean-Claude told 60 Minutes in 2005, is simply art.
It's only a work of art of joy and beauty. We do not build messages, we do not build symbols. It's only a work of art, nothing else.
Christo's art will return to the streets of Paris at least one more time. It'll be the completion of an unfinished project. The Arc de Triomphe will be wrapped in 25,000 square meters of recyclable silvery blue fabric and 7,000 meters of red rope. The two-week-long installation is set to unveil in September of next year. According to a statement on the artist's Facebook page, Christo died of natural causes at his home in New York City on Sunday. He was 84. You join us every weekday to hear the stories that connect you to the world. That connection continues on social media. Join the conversation about the important stories that impact you, then share the impact with others. Follow us on Twitter to stay connected. Our handle is easy to remember. We are at The World. June is Gay Pride Month. Big parties, big parades, but during a pandemic, Pride is moving online. Many are worried that going virtual could be a step back.
It's easier to ignore if it is not in a physical public space.
But there's also an opportunity to bring Pride to new corners of the globe. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Returning to our top story today, the global reaction to the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. U.S. adversaries are also watching, calling attention to racial injustice and police brutality. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, their concerns have also veered into anti-U.S. propaganda.
For about a week now, the Iranian state media has been fixated on the murder of George Floyd and the protests that followed his death in the U.S. One after another, experts and analysts prated on national TV to discuss police brutality and racial injustices in America. Mehsan Bizar is an Iranian journalist in Istanbul. He's been following the coverage and recalled a few of the headlines for me.
Anger over racism, the expansion of protests across the U.S., and the curfew which has been imposed in several states. And another one, Trump in crisis.
Bizarre says back in November, major protests broke out in Iran. Back then, American officials were quick to condemn the way Iranian security forces responded to the protests. Now, he says, the Iranians are giving the Americans a taste of their own medicine.
So they're kind of trying to hold like a mirror in front of their face to show them that you are acting just as we did or even worse than what we did.
Iran's supreme leader went on a Twitter tirade. He talked about the history of slavery in America. In the U.S., if you're dark-skinned, you can't be sure you'll be alive in the next few minutes, he wrote in English. Hashtag, I can't breathe. Hashtag, Black Lives Matter. This type of thing has filled the airwaves and social media in other countries seeking to criticize America too.
Американский Миннеаполис в режиме уличной войны.
This Russian state TV presenter says there's a street war going on in Minneapolis, and the issue at the heart of it is race. In a statement, Russia's foreign ministry said American police commit such high-profile crimes all too often. And from Beijing,
我们关注美国因乔治·弗洛伊德之死.
The Chinese foreign affairs spokesman emphasized that lives of black people matter. He described racial discrimination in the U.S. as, quote, chronic illness. On Sunday, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien was asked about the critical coverage on ABC's This Week.
The difference between our country and many of the authoritarian countries out there, when something like this happens, we investigate it. Our people protest, they petition their government for redress, and we stand with the protesters. It's the violent...
Experts point out Russia, China, Iran, and Turkey have abysmal human rights records of their own, and they're using this moment to amp up their anti-American propaganda. Daniel Dresner, who teaches at Tufts University's Fletcher School, says this type of coverage is nothing new.
As long as the United States has had adversaries, since the end of the Second World War, those adversaries have tried to focus on America's myriad flaws.
But he says what makes today different from the past is that the discord is not hard to find.
You know, in addition to reporting on, let's say, unrest in New York or in Minneapolis or somewhere else, you also have video. You also have sound. And the other way in which I mean that is that, simply put, we're currently witnessing, you can argue, the greatest amount of unrest in this country since 1968. And this is something that you might be able to tell people or exaggerate the degree of discord in the United States, but the video doesn't lie.
Dresner says many of the ills that the U.S.'s adversaries point out are true. But he says some policies embraced by the Trump administration make it harder for the U.S. to criticize authoritarian regimes. For example, he says, last week, when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was blasting the Chinese Communist Party for censoring China's internet, President Trump was tweeting that the government should regulate Twitter.
Now, you know, to be fair, one was ineffectual in terms of the United States, whereas what China's doing is very serious. But nonetheless, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that this reeks of hypocrisy.
Meanwhile, on Monday, Iran's state media turned its focus to the place where President Trump spent Friday night. It said as the protests raged outside, the American leader hid inside his White House bunker. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
China has also been trying to score propaganda points from the protests in the U.S. China's other clear problem with the U.S. right now, though, is over Hong Kong. President Trump said on Friday that Washington will end the special status for trade that Hong Kong has long enjoyed. That move was in response to China's decision to impose a new national security law limiting civil liberties in Hong Kong. The territory's special status with the U.S. has helped make it a major international financial hub, and many in Hong Kong are worried that they could become collateral damage in U.S.-China tension. More than 1,000 American companies do business there. Tara Joseph is the head of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. She says the end of special status is a big setback.
It's a psychological blow. We really didn't think this day would come, and we've spent lots of time together trying to figure out what it actually means. I mean, you don't just flip a switch and end a special economic relationship that's been in place for years. To unwind it will take some time and some thorough understanding of what it means. Does it mean tariffs? Does it mean a change in a special customs treatment for Hong Kong?
Right. So 85,000 American citizens live in Hong Kong. Many of them are employed in the financial industry. How emotional a moment is it for that community hearing this announcement?
People called it a sad day and couldn't quite believe that this could actually happen. But that said, it's not as if people are running for the exits or packing their bags immediately. A lot of the financial services people who are based here really work with China and to China. It's a very big market. So they're trying to figure out what the risks are of holding on.
Do you feel, Tara, in a way, abandoned by the U.S. government?
No, not necessarily. I think the sadness is it's too bad that Hong Kong could become collateral damage in this relationship. We've been saying for the last few years, when we make visits to Washington, don't run the bus over Hong Kong. Hong Kong's a winning place to be.
What about clout among businesses in Hong Kong with top Communist Party officials in Beijing? Does that exist and does it count?
There is a sizable pro-Beijing establishment in Hong Kong, and quite a few of the so-called tycoons do have close ties. They're involved in the politics and visit mainland China quite frequently. So yes, there is some clout here. And if you listen to the Hong Kong government, they're pretty much parroting what Beijing says, certainly in terms of the national security law, etc.
But do any of those people in Hong Kong who are connected to Beijing, do they carry any weight on behalf of Hong Kongers who are fighting for their civil liberties?
It's a complicated world in Hong Kong. We have at the top a group of very wealthy families. They have various ties. Many of them have children living in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Canada, etc. And some of them also have strong ties to Beijing. Some folks play it both ways. It's kind of a complicated system here, and it's intertwined somewhat. But the latest situation has changed that because it's a dangerous time for some of these tycoon families where they've seen their properties damaged. They own shopping malls and other places. It's a very difficult line for them right now.
I'm curious, do you have disagreements with Americans in Hong Kong who feel like economic stability needs to be the preface before any discussion of civil liberties?
There is a group that may believe that. And if people are here to simply make money, they may forego that notion of civil liberties and say, well, my job here is to deliver shareholder value. I'm not from Hong Kong. I may only be here a few years. They may take that type of stance. If you're working in media or in education here, you would probably feel that civil liberties are quite important. If you're here to make a big profit, and that's your job, you may say, well, it's not about freedom, it's about economics, and that's why I'm in Hong Kong.
Tara Joseph, the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. She's been speaking with us from Hong Kong. Tara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today marks the start of Pride Month. LGBTQ communities around the globe in June typically would fill the streets with millions for day-long parades. But as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, this year's events will look pretty different.
Kieran Robertson will never forget his first time at the Edinburgh Pride Parade.
It was a rainy day, unfortunately, but it didn't matter at all because I was just so overwhelmed and happy. I was so overwhelming that I cried.
Robertson had come out as queer that fall, and every year since then, he's made the parade a priority.
It's the feeling of community, the feeling of strength in a world that pushes back against the queer community all the time.
That feeling, found through dancing and marching through the streets with tens of thousands of people, will not be a reality this year. Edinburgh Pride has been canceled, along with about 500 other Pride events around the world.
Oh my God, the loss is indescribable.
Steve Taylor is a board member of the European Pride Organizers Association. He spent years helping plan Pride events and create spaces for queer people to feel safe and welcome.
And the fact that so many people won't have that in-person experience this year is really the worst thing about it.
To try and rectify that loss, enter Global Pride, a virtual event on Saturday, June 27th. The free 24-hour live stream will showcase speeches and performances sent in from Pride organizers across the globe. BYO, rainbows, glitter, and queer pride. But the event will exist exclusively on a screen. And some people, including Kieran Robertson in Scotland, worry that the virtual aspect could push an already isolated community further into obscurity.
It's easier to ignore if it is not in a physical public space.
Global Pride organizers admit that it won't be the same as an in-person celebration. But Taylor says the live stream could provide more exposure for prides around the world.
Wherever you are in the world, you'll be able to see content from prides in India, in Taiwan, in Australia, right the way across to the West Coast USA.
Taylor said the online format could also bring pride events to people who wouldn't otherwise have access to them, like people in Kenya, Barbados, Saudi Arabia, and other countries that criminalize homosexuality. But going virtual brings its own risks. You may have heard of Zoom bombing, when uninvited guests crash a video call with vulgar images or hate speech. Taylor says Global Pride is working with tech partners to keep the space safe.
We can't be 100% secure, but we will do absolutely everything we can.
Global Pride will have one similarity to modern Pride events: ads from major corporations. Critics say Pride has become a space for companies to virtue signal their support for the LGBTQ community. Kieran Robertson agrees.
I really don't like companies that are using Pride as a means of marketing. Years of protest and suffering is being used to sell people's stuff, which is nasty, in my opinion.
Taylor confirmed that Global Pride will include sponsorship deals, and he welcomes them.
If a corporate invests, say, $50,000 in a Pride, that's $50,000 that the Pride organization doesn't have to charge the people who attend. So they help to keep Pride free. And to me, that's the most important thing.
Some members of the LGBTQ community say it's those same corporations that exploit and oppress people of color. Pride is a celebration, but by nature, it's also a protest.
Queer lives matter!
Black queer lives matter!
Black trans lives matter!
Black trans lives matter!
At Toronto Pride in 2016, the city's Black Lives Matter group staged a sit-in, asking for better representation at Pride and a ban on police floats in future parades. Taylor says activist groups like this will be a key feature of the virtual Global Pride event.
We'll be featuring them, we'll be featuring their issues. In some countries, you can still be given the death penalty for being LGBTI. So it's absolutely critical that we have the balance between those different issues.
For queer people who report feeling excluded at Pride, this year's Move Online is an opportunity to create their own celebration. But for Robertson, there's no way of recreating the live experience of Pride. So he is tuning out.
It's not going to feel the same at all, because it is so much about being with other people, sharing the same energy.
But when I mentioned that people were planning their own parties at home, Robertson said that actually sounded pretty fun.
that's quite a refreshing idea. I'm sure we'll figure something out and we'll play games and listen to queer music.
He says parades have been canceled. Pride has not. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
American meatpacking plants are starting to reopen despite workers still testing positive for COVID-19. These plants have emerged as coronavirus hotspots. Cramped conditions, long hours, and lack of testing are some of the reasons why. Ireland is also facing the same pressure to stave off disease and keep supplying the country with meat. Think about the Irish breakfast fry-up, for example. You've got bacon and sausage alongside those eggs, and your day has barely started. Greg Ennis is a union leader in Ireland, has been calling on the Irish government to protect workers at meatpacking facilities. Greg, we've been hearing about the rise of coronavirus cases in the U.S. in meatpacking facilities here and what those working conditions are like. What are conditions for meatpackers in Ireland, and are plants still open or shut there?
Well, Marco, I would argue pro rata, it's actually worse in Ireland because you mentioned in your intro about meat plants reopening. In Ireland, those meat plants haven't been shut down, which I think is a very serious situation that's transpired here over the last couple of months, because we have about 15,000 people who work in the meat processing industry in Ireland, many of them migrant workers, and we have 956 confirmed COVID cases. So, you know, it's a very, very serious situation. I think in any other industry where you've got workforce of circa 30% with confirmed cases, those industries would be shut down, but not in the meat industry in Ireland.
And who are the workers in Ireland's meat packing industry?
There's Irish workers, there's Eastern European workers, there's workers from Brazil, from South Africa. So they come from around a broad range of nationalities. The meat industry in Ireland, you know, I seen this 3 months ago as the perfect storm in the context of transmitting COVID. And there's a number of vectors that I see within the industry in Ireland. You've got obviously close proximity working on meat lines. You've got industrial air cooling systems, bottlenecks in canteens and toilets, a low wage, a relatively very low wage industry in Ireland, which forces workers into carpooling and sharing accommodation, indeed sharing rooms within the accommodation. Workers can't stagger breaks or start times. And then there's obviously noise pollution, which forces workers to shout and so on in the workplace, spreading droplets, etc. So it is a perfect storm. We've raised concerns way back with the Minister of Agriculture in Ireland. We saw mandatory temperature testing of workers. While it wasn't a panacea, it was a preventative measure. We didn't get that. Now, it's fair to say that most meat plants now have temperature testing. It's not mandatory, unfortunately. And some employers have worked well with CIPTU, which is the largest trade union in Ireland with 200,000 members. So while some have worked well with us, some have not.
I know you've urged the Irish government to immediately create a task force to deal with the situation. You're calling it a farm-to-fork task force. What is their response so far, and can you explain what that task force, what you envision it as?
Farm-to-fork task force, Marco, is just a term I put on it, because I believe anyone involved with livestock and the moving of livestock into the processing facilities, the meat processors, the workers, and even the customers, I think should have been brought to the table, albeit remotely, to discuss this matter and to put in every measure possible. Because, you know, some people claim they're doing everything they can. I don't believe they're doing everything to try and address these issues. And, you know, I think the only solution that I see in this in the longer term is we have got to improve terms and conditions of employment. Because the fact that workers in most cases do not have sick pay, for example, that forces those workers, Marco, to go out and maybe continue working when they may have the virus because they have no other choice. So we will now push ahead to organise further, to build trade union power and to bring in a new minimum wage. And maybe then the employers will take note of what really is happening here, because what's happening in Ireland in the meat industry is highly, highly dangerous. It's affecting the communities. It's affecting the workers and their families. And I think the response from the government in particular on this has been lackluster at best. And from some of the agencies has been downright incompetent.
Greg Ennis with the labor union CIPTU, that Services Industrial Professional Technical Union, speaking with us from just outside Dublin. Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The pandemic has affected the globe in so many different ways. Because of the outbreak and also due partly to closed borders, a large group of migrants is stranded in the rainforest in Panama. They're in limbo in a makeshift camp in the jungle. A human rights tribunal is now calling on Panama's government to provide daily necessities for the migrants. Panamanian officials say they would prefer to put the people on buses and send them to Costa Rica. But the government there says not so fast.
Hasta que no se establezca.
Costa Rica's top immigration official, Raquel Vargas, says the migrants will not leave Panama until the region returns to normal. The World's Jorge Valencia spoke with one man who's stepping in to help.
Edwin Ramirez is a local pastor.
Mi nombre es Edwin, soy el pastor Edwin Ramirez, pastor de la iglesia cuadrangular.
Ramirez lives about a 30-minute drive from the migrant station in an area known as the Darien Gap. Still, he didn't know about the situation until he got a Facebook message from a random stranger in Spain.
No sé cómo, a través de Facebook, encontró un teléfono mío, mi número de teléfono, y me llamó.
I don't know how she found me, he says. I was surprised. But apparently she knew one of the migrants in the camp and asked the pastor to help.
Y él me decía, pastor, hay días que no como nada. Hay días que paso mucha hambre, no solamente yo, todos los que estamos aquí.
Ramirez says he texted the man of the camp, who told the pastor that he was going hungry. In fact, a lot of people were. In total, there are about 2,500 people in the migrant station. Ramirez says he visited the migrant station and handed the man some food and some clothes. And that was when he really began to understand how bad things are. Pastor Ramirez says small children are walking around with no clothes on. Some of the women appear to be in the later stages of pregnancy. Most migrants are from Haiti, though they're also from Cuba, Senegal, and India. UNICEF says about a third of them are children, and 11 have given birth since the Panamanian government began corralling them. Some 50 people have been infected with the coronavirus, and there's a serious shortage of medical attention. In a statement, UNICEF says that managing the COVID-19 outbreak has been practically impossible. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights ordered the Panamanian government last week to do something about the situation. Panama's health ministry says they are looking to build more shelters. Pastor Edwin Ramirez says he's passionate about helping people and that Jesus says in the Bible that if a stranger is in need, you should help. So Ramirez says he collected money for food. He says he bought 90 meals, but that was very little when he delivered them. There are, after all, more than 2,000 people. But he says the locals are mostly subsistence farmers and that they're in need themselves. Ramirez says he then got help from some of the younger guys in his congregation. Last Thursday, they went around collecting mangoes, which grow all over the place near his house. When they pulled up to the migrant station with two trunkfuls of fruit, Ramirez says the mangoes were gone in minutes. He says he wants to do more and that he wrote to a food bank in Panama City for help. He says he hopes that next time he can deliver bread and milk to the migrants. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
And that is our show for this Monday. You can continue to follow us when we're not on air. Come to theworld.org to find all of our coverage. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. Stay strong. Stay safe. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.